John Wood has said that in his perfect world, he could start any sentence with the words, every child, as in every child knows how to read or every child has access to books. With that goal in mind, 12 years ago, Mr. Wood quit his lucrative marketing job at Microsoft to launch a project called Room to Read to build school libraries in the developing world. In his latest book, Creating Room to Read, he explains how he built a $50 million a year nonprofit enterprise that to date has opened more than 15,000 libraries in Nepal, Sri Lanka, Laos, Cambodia, and other countries with underserved children, and has established 8 million children's books in 25 languages. Viking is his publisher, and I'm pleased to welcome John Wood to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. Good to see you.
Now, you've called yourself a library nerd. Has that always been the case?
It has from my very earliest days. Actually, my eighth birthday, my main present from my parents was a green bicycle with one of those old-fashioned banana seats, and that was the library transport vehicle. My father said this is a leveraged investment because if you go to the library every week and check books out and learn to read, you're going to be set for life. So I feel lucky I got to grow up in a country where libraries are pretty prevalent.
Well, as a former executive of Microsoft, do you feel any responsibility for the closings of so many libraries in this country, often blamed on the impact of the internet?
Well, I mean, I think that there's many causes for all problems. I think pointing one finger, I mean, I think that the Gates Foundation is doing a really good job of investing in libraries. But I think one of the major problems for the world today is what we take for granted here in America simply doesn't exist in the poorest parts of the world. The poor children are penalized for being born in the wrong place at the wrong time. They don't have access to books. They don't learn to read. What chances are that they're going to get out of poverty?
And you've said that the idea to build libraries for the world's poorest children first occurred to you while you were on vacation from Microsoft in Nepal in 1998. Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, I was on an 18-day trek in the Annapurna region trying to get away from the hurly-burly pace of life at Microsoft. I met a headmaster who had about 450 children showing up at his school every day. And he was really enthusiastic. He said, please come tour my school. And I thought this would be a chance to see the real Nepal, not the tourist Nepal. Dilapidated conditions, dirt floors, no desks. Most importantly, the library was completely devoid of books. And I said to the headmaster, how can this be? You have 450 students showing up every day. Their parents want them to learn. You have no books. And he spoke a sentence that would change my life forever. He said, in Nepal, we are too poor to educate our children. But if we don't educate our children, we will always remain poor. And that struck me as a pretty difficult catch-22.
And they did have books, didn't they? But they kept them locked up because they were so precious?
Well, the books they had were backpacker cast-offs. Obviously, other backpackers like me had come through and felt sympathetic. But, you know, they were leaving behind, you know, Danielle Steele romance novels and James Joyce and Umberto Eco and stuff that no child would
want to
read.
Don't mention Jackie Collins. She just left.
I know she just left, and that's why I said Danielle Steele. I think every child should read Danielle Steele at some point in their pedagogical development, don't you?
Someone at the school suggested that you return someday and donate some books. So is that when you decided that you would make this one of your goals in life?
Yes. Thankfully, the headmaster, like me, was an action-oriented optimist. He gave me a homework assignment. He said, perhaps, sir, you will someday come back with books. And it was a very humble request. But the look on his face, to me, just expressed how much he wanted these children to be able to learn. So I did a book drive over the internet. My parents helped me out. We collected 3,000 books from friends and from publishers like Scholastic who got behind us. And a year later, my 73-year-old father, myself, and 6 rented donkeys returned to that little village with 3,000 books. And it was the biggest day in the history of that community.
Could they fit them all in the library?
Well, thankfully, they could. We helped them to also clear some space and make space. And eventually, we went in, once Room to Read, the charity I started was formed, we went in and formalized the partnership to actually build a proper library room with bright colors and bookshelves and things like that so the kids would have a proper library, not just a bunch of books.
But you were at Microsoft. How long did you stay at Microsoft before you decided to change your life around?
Within about 8 weeks of that actual trip back to that village of Bahundan in Nepal, I had resigned. Took a lot of fortitude and intestinal fortitude because a lot of people didn't understand. They thought I was crazy. I was going from having this title of Director of Business Development for Microsoft China. This was 99 during the tech boom when people were clamoring to get into tech, and here I was clamoring to get out of tech. But I quit within 2 months and decided I would devote my life to replicating that scene hundreds of times.
And you started Room to Read with what you've called the big, hairy, audacious goal of reaching 10 million children by 2020. Aren't you now scheduled to reach that number of children much sooner?
We are, thankfully. I was told that was a crazy hubristic goal when I set out, because we didn't have an endowment. We didn't have any fundraising experience. But thankfully, I've always thought bold goals attract bold people. And I'm really lucky that a lot of great people have joined on, and we'll reach 10 million children by 2015 under our current trajectory.
How often do you open a library?
We open on average, believe it or not, 6 libraries a day across the developing world. It's a new library every 4 hours. Opening somewhere. So between the time you go to bed and the time you wake up, if you get a good night's sleep, 2 libraries will have opened.
And how many children are projected to be served by that?
We have 7.5 million children now across 10 countries in the poorest parts of Asia and Africa who have access to our schools and libraries and our literacy programs. And we expect that number to grow to about 10 million by 2015. And after that, the sky's the limit. We hope to go even bigger after that.
Are you building separate library buildings, or are you putting these libraries into school buildings?
Ideally, the school can give us a room, because if they can give us the room, it means our cost to establish the library is only $5,000. It's a very small amount of money to affect literally hundreds of kids. If the school is overcrowded and we need to build a separate building, which I refer to as kind of a mini Carnegie, it's kind of like Carnegie's library building program, those projects typically run between about $20,000 and $30,000 to build the building, but also to kit it out. And we also then allow the sponsor to actually put their name on it. So if people want to dedicate a school to their mother for her birthday, or to their grandmother or their favorite teacher, these are all dedicatable, so people get a real sense of connection to the library they've built.
My guest is John Wood, whose latest book is Creating Room to Read, A Story of Hope in the Battle for Global Literacy. It's published by Viking. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Your previous book was Leaving Microsoft to Change the World, which you talked about that part of the story. But you have to deal with a little bit here as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, the first book came out in 2006, and it was really about my own personal journey, where I discovered my passion to help kids who were the poorest of the poor to get educated, really blew up my old life and started over. This new book, Creating Room to Read, A Story of Hope in the Battle for Global Literacy, is more the story of the organization and how we've scaled way beyond my wildest dreams.
And you've said that you think of Room to Read as a business rather than as a charitable venture or an NGO. Why do you make that distinction?
Well, we try at Room to Read to run ourselves in a very business-like way. A lot of our executive team comes from the private sector, so we're trying to think very boldly. I'll give you one example of this. We set the goal early on that we would emulate the private sector by scaling, because when the private sector sees opportunity, they scale rapidly. So we looked at places like Starbucks to say, how many outlets did Starbucks open in year one after their IPO of their stock, in year five, in year 10? And we've actually managed to out Starbucks.
Well, Starbucks, of course, wound up in a situation where they had too many outlets and they've closed some of them down. You're not doing this with the libraries.
Thankfully not. We're funded by the Gates Foundation to actually go out and do evaluations to test the efficacy of our work. And I'm proud to say that when those libraries become independent and they're run by the community, we've found that 98% of them are still up and running after they become independent.
Are people more likely to make excuses for poor performance if they think of their organization as a charity rather than as a business?
I think sometimes they do. I think sometimes people get frustrated, but they say, oh, it's a charity. It doesn't need to be run as well as a business. And the reality is charities should be run even more efficiently than businesses, because no offense to, let's say, Ben and Jerry's, but if ice cream doesn't get into the supermarket freezer, you still have 3 or 4 ice creams to choose from. If a child doesn't have clean water or vaccinations or literacy, what chance do they have to better their lives?
So from the start, you've managed the organization using strict business practices, including outside audits, independent customer satisfaction surveys, the sort of things that you did when you were at Microsoft?
And actually even more radical than I did at Microsoft, because we have incredibly innovative ways to cut costs. So we have bankers from Goldman Sachs and Barclays who compete to donate the most frequent flyer miles so I can fly around the world for free. We have hotel chains giving us free room nights, like Hilton, 150 free room nights a year. We have companies like Credit Suisse giving us office space in major capitals, major money centers like London, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and Sydney. So we can actually do things that a for-profit business couldn't do. If Microsoft said to Credit Suisse, can you give us office space, they would say, you're crazy. When I say it, they pretty much look at me like I'm crazy, but say, okay, we'll at least consider that. So we've been able to shave millions of dollars out of our cost structure by relying on crazy favors like asking bankers for their frequent flyer miles.
Now, what about the customer satisfaction surveys? Are you asking the kids about whether you're satisfying them?
We'll ask the students, we'll ask the teachers, many times we'll ask the community members. I talk in the new book about an example where we went and surveyed students in both Nepal and Vietnam to ask them, what would cause you to use the library more often? Would it be longer hours, open at night, open weekends, et cetera? 52% of the kids chose the number one answer, more books in the mother tongue, more books in Vietnamese, more books in Nepalese.
Rather than in English.
And that sounds pretty obvious. Of course, a child wants to have books in their mother tongue. But one of the biggest challenges in the world today is that the for-profit publishers don't publish books in languages spoken by those living in less than a dollar a day because they can't afford it. So we have become at Room to Read one of the biggest children's publishers you've never heard of because we're working with local authors, local artists to produce world-class original children's literature. In the book, there's a chapter that I call Searching for Seuss, and it's all about how we are searching for the Dr. Seuss of Cambodia and the J.K. Rowling of Sri Lanka.
Well, the big problem in a country like Nepal is that 70% of the adults are illiterate, so why would anybody even go into the publishing business?
Exactly. And that's why we've gone into it in a big way, because I think that if an entrepreneur views a vacuum as an opportunity, so does a social entrepreneur. We looked at that and said, if we can get the publishing arm of this operation right, we can impact millions of kids. And I'm proud to say that our local teams have now published over 850 original titles, and this year we'll produce our 1,000th original title.
You said you were looking for a Dr. Seuss. Haven't you written some children's books yourself? It's hard to rhyme in Nepalese, isn't it,
if you
don't speak the language?
I'm not sure my children's books are necessarily up there with Dr. Seuss, but I did write a series of books that are based on a character called Zack the Yak. The first one was called Zack the Yak with Books on His Back, and it was all about basically helping children understand that kids everywhere in the world don't have books like they do. So Zack is a colorful character who helps kids around the world by delivering books to them, whether it be in rural Vietnam or the Himalayas.
And you said that you turn these things over to your local staff. Do you rely on your local staff to solve the local problems?
We do. We are probably 96% plus in-country teams are local nationals. We're not a bunch of Americans driving around in Land Rovers telling the local people what to do. It's strong Cambodians in Cambodia, strong South Africans in South Africa. And I think that really is a way that we've been able to really challenge the communities we work with to co-invest alongside of us, because that negotiation is being done at the local level in the local language.
And they would also know who the local writers who might best supply them with books are.
Exactly. And they also know where to get the resources, because every project we do requires community co-investment. We don't build the school or the library for the local people. We actually do it with them. We require the local community to put in sweat equity to each project. And that, to me, is the best part of the model, because it's not a free gift from somebody in the UK or Switzerland. It is a co-investment from somebody, let's say, here in New York, who says, I'll invest in this school or library, but the local community is going to co-invest through sweat equity.
So how many books did your Nepal office produce initially, and how many have they printed?
Initially, it was only 10 books in 2004. We were very fortunate that the Skoll Foundation, funded by Jeff Skoll, the legendary and very inspirational founding CEO of eBay, took a little bet on us, gave us enough money to produce the first 10 titles. And from that, now we're going to produce 100x. We're going to have over 1,000 titles by the end of this year.
And are they mostly about Zack? Well, Zack the Yak wouldn't have much meaning in Nepal, would it?
Well, actually, Zack the Yak's been translated into several languages, including Nepalese, Sinhalese, and Tamil. So Zack's becoming quite an international character.
And would these books be similar to the kinds of books that children in the United States read, at least of that age?
Yeah, they're similar in many ways, because obviously they're very colorful. A lot of times it involves animals and things that kids love to read about. You try to have a small number of words per page for the first and second graders so they don't get overwhelmed. And many times we'll also produce the same book in English alongside of it. So if the child wants to use that book at two different points of their development, they can use that same story. They might use it once to learn Khmer and then use it again later in life to learn English.
And then you also encourage kids to write their own books.
We do. We have a wonderful story in my new book about these two teenage girls in Sri Lanka who conceived, wrote, and illustrated a story called Baby Fish Goes to School. And it's one of my favorite stories. It's about a little baby fish who watches all the animals on land walk to school every day, hears about what a wonderful place school is, and says to its mom, I want to go to school. And the mother says, well, you can't go to school. You're a fish. The school's on land. And baby fish is a little bit annoyed by this. But the next day, thankfully, the animals, being action-oriented optimists, go out. They come up with a solution. They buy a fishbowl. They scoop up baby fish. They take baby fish to school, plunk her down next to the chalkboard, and voila. Babyfish Goes to School. And in a certain sense, I think of Room to Read as that. It's one giant fishbowl trying to take all those kids who are excluded and say, we're going to make sure that you get to go to school and that you get to be literate and that you have equality for the girls so the girls also go to school.
But, of course, you're not talking about schools of fish. That's a whole other thing. Do you have programs?
If Pepperidge Farm wants to do a tie-in, you never know.
Do you have programs for teachers and librarians on how best to use these books?
We do. I would say when I started Room to Read, I was a little bit naive. I didn't realize the extent to which we would have to invest in professional development for the teachers and for the librarians. And thankfully, a lot of really great academic experts have come and joined the Room to Read team. And they've helped us to actually work with over 20,000 teachers in the last 2 years alone.
Because these teachers had never taught with books as source material.
That's exactly right. And many times there's not even a known pedagogy of how do you teach a child to read in a language like Khmer, which is script-based, or in a language like Lao. So we've had to really back up and say, let's not just set up libraries or publish books. Let's also make sure that the children are gaining literacy, comprehension, fluency, reading a decent number of words per minute. And that's been a big investment for us in the last couple of years.
What about nonfiction books?
Yeah, nonfiction is always great. One of my supporters always calls them true stories because she feels that nonfiction is defining something by what it's not. But, of course, boys are also very much, much more into true stories, so we do publish nonfiction as well as fiction.
Especially when the kids are a bit older.
How old do
you aim these books at?
The books themselves are primarily aimed at grades 1 through 4 because that getting that literate environment right at an early stage is foundational. But I do think our publishing program will evolve as the kids get older and as their education evolves.
John Wood's latest book is Creating Room to Read, A Story of Hope in the Battle for Global Literacy. It's published by Viking. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with John Wood, who's the founder and board co-chair of Room to Read, one of the fastest-growing and award-winning charities founded this century. He has written a book about the experience called Creating Room to Read, A Story of Hope in the Battle for Global Literacy. It is published by Viking. So how many languages is Room to Read publishing children's books in these days?
22 at last count. Swahili was the most recent one that we added. We're now working in Tanzania. And pretty amazing to think there's over 100 million Swahili speakers in the world, but yet they still don't have a very vibrant children's book industry.
So where would Swahili books be published? Is that mostly South Africa or all throughout Africa?
Swahili is mostly spoken in Tanzania along with some parts of Kenya and Uganda. So for our Tanzania program, the libraries will all be bilingual. They'll be in both English and Swahili.
It all sounds so positive. Have you run into any problems along the way?
Oh, yeah, definitely. One of the criticisms of my first book was that people told me I made it look too easy. And that's kind of – I'm an optimist, so I always kind of gloss over problems. So in this book, I've really tried – the second book, I've tried to talk a lot more about the issues we run into, how we responded when we've run into corruption. How do we respond to the financial crisis? How do we respond when there's institutional barriers against girls and women getting educated? Because a key part of what we do, along with literacy, is making sure that we're focused also on gender equality so that more girls can go to school.
In countries where, in some cases, people shoot girls who talk for gender equality.
Exactly. It's the standard response of cowards to say we're not going to be part of the solution, we're going to be part of the problem. So Room to Read now has over 20,000 girls enrolled in our program, and they're promised that we will renew our support for them each and every year as long as they pass the next grade to the end of secondary school. And in the last 2 years, between 96% and 97% of those girls have passed the next grade. So they're showing a pretty brave response.
Do you have to be aware of local cultural differences?
We certainly
do. Some books could probably rub people the wrong way.
Well, every place that we work, we rely on very strong local teams rather than expats who come from abroad. That sounds obvious, but in a lot of international aid, it's foreigners who are running the organization. So we try to pay attention to that and really work with the local people. One of the things about the co-investment model is that if the local communities are co-investing, they feel a sense of skin in the game, so they're not shy about telling you what's good and what needs to be improved.
I mentioned South Africa because you talk about problems you encountered there. Ooh, can you tell that story?
Yeah, when we started in South Africa, we hired our local team. We ended up having some problems with, funds that were supposed to be deployed against education projects being deployed against stuff that we couldn't really track. It didn't really feel right. We sent in auditors, and it was, you know, a little bit of a punch in the gut when you realize that you're working hard to help a part of the world where, you know, Nelson Mandela said, if you want to help South Africa, the best thing you can do is help us educate our children. But with corruption, we have a zero tolerance policy towards it, and we audit often. We have a former Microsoft CFO running our audit committee, and if we find financial malfeasance, we basically have no tolerance for it and get rid of those people.
But also, wasn't your staff put into danger as a result?
Yeah, there were some threats made that probably our legal counsel would probably prefer I not talk about on radio. But yeah, there were
politicians who wanted to take a little piece off the top, whether it's in South Africa or anywhere else, can make life rather difficult for an organization like yours, even though what you're doing is to the benefit of their country.
And that's one reason that we have a model where we tell the local governments when we come in, you cannot ask us for money, because we're going to turn things around and ask you for money. And we're not asking that government for bribes. We're saying to that government, if we build a school, we want you to provide the teachers and pay their salaries, for a library, pay the librarian's salaries. So we turn it around and tell the local governments, we're going to be asking you for resources each and every year.
So this is the challenge grant model that you're
basing on? It is. Every school we do, every library we establish is a three-part agreement between Room to Read, the local community, which is often cash poor, but some of the parents might even put 100 or 200 rupees into the pot. And of course, they put sweat equity in, and then the Ministry of Education provides the salaries for the teachers and the librarians.
So that's the advantage of that is that you wind up only working with motivated communities.
Exactly.
They have a financial stake in it.
And you can't help people who don't want to help themselves. So if a community says, we don't really want to do this, we don't have the time to dig the foundation, we say, fine, that next community over yonder wants us more than you want us.
But most of the communities you work with are extremely poor. How do they come up with the necessary money?
Well, if they have even small amounts of cash, in Nepal, for example, 100 rupees is about a dollar and a half. So some families will put in 100 rupees, but also they get credit from Room to Read for anything they do that is physical labor. So it can be hauling sand up from the riverside to mix into the cement, sawing logs to build the bookshelves, pounding nails, painting the walls of the school, things like that. In my book, I even talk about a community in Sri Lanka where every month the kids run a little farmer's market with produce from their family's farm plot, but that money does not stay with the kids. That money goes into the school maintenance fund. So Room to Read helped them to build the library, but they're actually buying the paint and paying for the upkeep, and then the parents are actually painting the building. And that's just one little story of this initiative that we see throughout the developing world where people are very hungry for education.
Didn't you left Microsoft before Bill Gates stepped down to run his charitable foundation.
I did, yes.
Do you think that you inspired him in any way?
No, I was really excited.
Did you discuss the idea with him before you got started?
I didn't know Bill very well. I had worked for Melinda, who's fantastic. I think that what she and Bill are doing is amazing, and I hope that more billionaires will emulate them in a big way, not a small way. But I worked more closely with Steve Ballmer than I did with Bill. Steve was more the business guy. Bill was a bit more the tech guy, not to simplify things too much, but I was on the business side of it. But I love what Gates is doing, and I love the fact that there's this whole giving pledge. I do wish that the billionaires would deploy the money faster than they are. I think it's a bit ridiculous that foundations are allowed to give away only 5% of their assets per year. Because if a charity like Room to Read only spent 5% of our assets per year, people would say, what are you doing? You're sitting on the sidelines. And there's so many great NGOs out there that need the funding because we have literally hundreds of villages asking us for help, and we're having to say, not yet, not yet, not yet. So I do hope if any of the world's billionaires are listening, please deploy that money faster because of going back to Ben Franklin, right? It's like an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
But you have.
I hope that was Ben Franklin, by the way, who said that.
Well, if it isn't, believe me, listeners will start writing in and complaining.
They can tell me. Can I tell them my Twitter feed is John Wood RTR? I'd be happy to be corrected.
Doesn't Steve Ballmer have a reputation for being a very demanding boss? Are you?
I think that Steve was demanding and voluble. I think that I'm quietly demanding. My employees can also tell me on Twitter if I'm wrong on that. But I stopped being CEO about 4.5 years ago. And we have this wonderful CEO, Erin Ganji, my co-founder. She's ex-Goldman, ex-Unilever. And most of the organization reports into her. So that really frees me up to be a full-time ambassador for the organization.
And a fundraiser? You've called your network of fundraising chapters your secret weapon. What are fundraising chapters?
Fundraising chapters are full of people who are passionate for our cause. They're not going to quit their day job. We tell them, keep your day job, but just carve out a small percent of your time and your network to help us to raise money. So we have 57 chapters around the world with over 10,000 volunteers who throw events. It might be as small as Let's Fund a Library. It might be as big as an event that might fund 10 or 20 schools.
And you advise them to keep it cheap and cheerful?
We do.
You don't invite the high rollers to these things.
We invite anybody and everybody who wants to support our cause. But the main thing we do is, you know, we don't pay celebrities appearance fees to show up. We try not to do silly things that send the wrong signal to say you spent $1,000 on a ticket, but only $100 went to the charity. We try to keep things as efficient as possible and rely on donations. So Moët Hennessy gives us a champagne, and that saves us just a lot of money right there.
Well, there's been a big debate in the fundraising NGO community over what percentage of the money raised actually should go into the mission and how mm-hmm. much should go into paying people who are really competent and who can do a good job. And I've seen studies that show in some cases that when people try to keep the percentage high in going into the mission, they sometimes don't raise as much money because they don't do it as well as the professionals might do. So where do you stand on all of that?
Well, I think I talk in a book about this. I think overhead, which is the classic term for your fundraising expenses plus your admin,
people are shocked if they see some organization spending only 30% of the money that they raise on the thing that they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, at Room to Read, we spend 83 cents in a dollar directly on programs, only 17% on overhead. We're Charity Navigator 4-star rated year after year after year after year, 7 consecutive years, which only 2% of NGOs based in America can say. Now, I do think with overhead, it's a bit like cholesterol, right? There's good cholesterol and there's bad cholesterol. And I think having a great CFO, keeping a track of the books, paying a good audit firm to come in and audit your books, those to me are good overhead. What's not very good overhead is paying a celebrity to appear at one of your events or, you know, booking a first-class flight overseas and paying a lot of money for it when you could have just done what we do and go to those bankers to say, hey, you have more miles than you care to spend. Let us borrow, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, borrow your frequent flyer miles, or let us borrow office space. I think there's a lot more things a charity world can do to find ways to save costs. And even if you're running a clean water charity, hey, that means more money goes to the water wells, not to fundraising expenses.
And can they write those things off?
Yeah, I believe so. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably
so it's tax deductible, and it feels less painful.
Yeah, it does. And I think also for a lot of companies we work with, though, they don't just want to be a check. They want to actually engage in ways that really get them excited intellectually. And what happens a lot of times now is people will spread the word to say, hey, I gave Room to Read my frequent flyer miles, or we're giving Room to Read free hotel nights. You should too.
What advice would you give to someone who wants to start a nonprofit from scratch?
I think the first piece of advice I would give them is try to figure out whether or not you should create something from scratch, or is there an existing group doing something very similar where that car might be in second gear or third gear, and if you helped it, you could actually get that car moving faster, because it does take a lot of effort to get a charity off the ground, and there's 1.2 million NGOs in America alone. There's 10 million in India. So the question is, do you really want to start it from scratch, or do you want to find somebody already doing great work and help them to get more done faster?
You mentioned empowering girls and helping them get an education, which has become one of Room to Read's priorities. Some of our listeners may have watched your work with girls in the documentary called Half the Sky, which was rebroadcast recently on PBS. When did you decide to expand Room to Read's mission to include a specific focus on girls' education?
We decided that very early because when we looked at the statistics of those who are out of school, it's pretty shocking to me that 200 million children across the developing world woke up this morning and did not go to school. It's a huge number, 200 million, but two-thirds of those are girls and women. There's 800 million people in the world today who are illiterate. Two-thirds are girls and women. So, you know, I'm going to do a quick shout-out to my grandmother, my mother, my older sister for reading to me. I'm the product of educated women. What chance do kids in the developing world have if their mother has a third-grade education?
But it's often because of cultural considerations.
It can be cultural.
Some people don't want their girls to be barefoot and pregnant.
But for every time we run into a cultural constraint, we probably run into 20 times as many examples where it's just a financial constraint. And that's not hard to solve because $250 per girl per year helps girls like those seen in the Half the Sky documentary go to school. It's an embarrassingly small amount of money to solve a humongous problem that is multi-generational in its benefits.
The Half the Sky documentary grew out of a book written by New York Times reporter Nicholas Kristof and his wife, Cheryl Wu. Do you work with them?
We do. I love Nick and Cheryl. We're very fortunate. Obviously, they have to remain independent as journalists. So although we get along great, they're also going to be very skeptical. And so I spent 4 days with Nick during the filming of Half the Sky, and he just fired question after question after question at our local. I mean, I learned why both he and Cheryl have won multiple Pulitzer Prizes. What was great about it was that once Nick was in Vietnam for a few days, I think he saw that our model stood the sniff test he was giving it. And it's wonderful because not only now has Half the Sky been rebroadcast, but they're working on Half the Sky 2, which will be another exciting project.
Because some other projects, which were quite wonderful, did have some problems. I'm thinking of the Mortensen project. Does that hurt you when you're out fundraising?
I don't think it does, because we use the example of Greg Mortensen to really talk about why Room to Read's model is different. You know, we have an 11-member board full of a lot of business leaders who make our life a bit more difficult in board meetings, but it's better to have an 11-member board that's independent than a 3-person board that's captive. We keep our overhead expenses low. We get 70 out of 70 points from Charity Navigator for transparency. We post multiple years of financials on our website at roomtoread.org. We even post our evaluations on our website.
Now, you've said that this book is the second in a planned trilogy. What are you planning to put in the third book?
I don't know. Do you have any ideas?
Oh, it's like that.
I've got a couple of ideas I'm swimming around, but nothing definite yet. If anybody has any ideas, please let me know.
Well, you've been in Asia and Africa. What about Latin America?
Latin America definitely is, I hope, if the fundraising goes well, a part of Room to Read's future. There's a lot of need. I was just in Colombia a couple of weeks ago, and I'm helping to mentor a young Colombian woman who's doing the equivalent of Room to Read in Colombia.
And then, of course, there are parts of America where there are no libraries and where we see serious illiteracy.
There are a lot of problems. Also, there's problems with not enough high school children figuring out what is the path to university. So I'm sitting on the board of a group now as my domestic arm of what I do called the National College Advising Council, which is doing great work helping kids to see the path to university.
Would you like to get more support from the federal government? Would that be possible?
We would. I just had meetings at State yesterday. We have a great relationship with the South Central Asia Bureau of State, which we work with them in Bangladesh, India, Nepal, and Sri Lanka using books and libraries as tools of diplomacy.
John Wood's second book, we don't know what's going to be in the third book. He doesn't either. It's called Creating Room to Read, A Story of Hope in the Battle for Global Literacy. It is published by Viking. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard.